Hello and welcome to the Forte Edge, your monthly podcast on all things legal tech, hosted by Forte Markets. My name is Armand, and this month we will be talking about the impact of legal skills of the future. We are joined by Brian Tang. Brian Tang is the founding executive director of the Light Lab at the Hong Kong University of Law to foster law, innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship. Brian was previously at Credit Suisse in Hong Kong and at Sullivan & Cromwell on Wall Street, as well as in the Silicon Valley, where he advised on some of the world's largest financial services and technology capital markets. Welcome, Brian. We're pleased to have you today. If you want to talk a bit about your background first, how you got where you are today, and what encouraged you to champion the adoption of legal technology within the global firms you work at.
Thank you very much, Armand, and thanks for the team over there at Forte for inviting me onto your podcast. So I'll try to give the short to medium version, shall we say. So I've had a conventionally decent law career. As you mentioned, I did an undergraduate double degree in arts and law in Perth in Australia. And at the time, wanted to work in international law. So I joined the largest and most international firm at the time, which was Mallesons, now known as King & Wood Mallesons. And then I went to New York to do my LLM at NYU, again, ostensibly to do more international law and cross-border work. Again, to cut this long story short, ended up joining Sullivan Cromwell in New York, large Wall Street firm, where I was able to do project financing in Latin America, but also more conventional IPOs and M&As and the like. As a mid-level associate, I wanted to come back to Asia, but my partners there said, Brian, you're kind of entrepreneurial. We'll help set up a Palo Alto office. So instead of heading east, I went west to Silicon Valley during the dot-com boom. The year was 2000, so there was the dot-com boom, and then there's the dot-com bust as we pushed out some of the last IPOs then. Came back to New York for a couple more years, and then was headhunted to join Credit Suisse in Hong Kong, covering the Asia-Pacific region. So again, had the good fortune to work on some of the largest, you know, IPOs in the world, as well as transactions in nearly every jurisdiction in the Asia-Pacific, including setting up Credit Suisse's joint venture in China. And then a few years ago, in what my wife calls an early midlife crisis, I left to go into startup land. So my startup ACMI started focusing more on fintech, so-called capital markets marketplaces, i.e. how to fundraise online, which later on included crypto, and also in regtech, so regulatory technology. And for example, I'm currently the co-chair of the RegTech Committee of the FinTech Association of Hong Kong, and we work closely with regulators to grow the RegTech ecosystem here. But I also had a social enterprise that I set up, and I called it Young Makers and Change Makers. And there, the focus was on inclusive K-12 STEAM or STEM education. And one of the programs we're best known for is introducing Technovation Girls Make Tech to Hong Kong, where girls aged 10 to 18 ideate, prototype, and then create apps to address the UN sustainable goals. And in our first year, our top Hong Kong team made it to the finals at Google at Silicon Valley, and they won. Around the same time, I learned about this thing called Global Legal Hackathon, and I thought, finally, hackathons are coming to the law. So I asked around and said, who's organizing it for Hong Kong? And nobody seemed to be doing it. So I said, well, look, if somebody will underwrite it, I'll organize it. So we organized the first legal tech and reg tech hackathon here in Hong Kong. And it was underwritten by Thomson Reuters in their great premises. And our top team made it to the finals in New York, and they won. So it was because of some of these, successes that Hong Kong U tapped me on the shoulder. I had known Hong Kong U for many years, and they had indicated that I was asked by an old friend there to say, Brian, you know, we'd like to launch a new initiative. Will you help lead it? So that's how I established Light Lab, Law, Innovation, Technology, and Entrepreneurship at Hong Kong U, and love to chat more and share more about what we're doing there and how that impacts the broader profession.
Yeah, that's definitely a very, very impressive background, Brian. So thank you for sharing that. So as we touched upon, and as you touched upon, you are the executive director of the Light Lab. And I was wondering what you are taking out of this initiative and in terms of education as well, because a lot, when we talk about legal skills, we also talk about legal tech education. So I was wondering, do you think that law schools should play a bigger role in teaching students new legal and technological skills? And do you think that those new skills should be integrated in the academic curriculum?
So I'm of course a little bit biased there because I was literally tapped by a highly ranked law school to do exactly that. So maybe let me share a little bit more color around that. So what appealed to me was the fact that Light Lab would be interdisciplinary as well as experiential. So it's not just a sage in the stage standing in the middle of the lecture room and telling people this what the lay of the land is and the law of the land. And so this is run by the Faculty of Law, but in conjunction with the Department of Computer Science. So the idea is that we would actually be making stuff. So one way to think about how I've kind of construed Light Lab is, it deals with the future of legal professionals and the relevant skill sets and mindsets. So while the industry is dramatically changing, these are the future legal professionals, and they have a longer tail of a career. And so technology and innovation certainly impacts their careers much more. So the question becomes how can they participate in that and embrace that as part of their journey? Then there's also the aspect about the law of technology. So, the ABCD technologies, AI, blockchain, cloud, and data. How is the law affecting that and addressing those developments? So hence, I'm quite actively involved in the blockchain space from the securities law analysis perspective, as you can imagine, as initial ICOs, so-called ICOs and now STOs, security token offerings. But also for AI, and I'm quite involved in the AI governance research and initiatives as well. So that's the law of technology. But importantly, one of the things we want to do is the technology of law. How can technology be used to better understand law, be applied to the legal practice, and to enable greater access to justice? So one has to remember that law is a professional discipline. Right. So I think a lot of your listeners will be from the legal profession. So they fully understand it's a regulated industry. And in many jurisdictions, there are minimum requirements of law schools before they can, graduate law students that would then qualify after taking bar exams to practice. In Australia, it's called the Priestly 11. In the US, it's the concept of the ABA approved law school. So various countries already have the professional bodies and educators who require certain minimum requirement or minimum things that need to be taught at law schools. And there's a lot of it, right? So at law schools, we are taught to trained to think like a lawyer, to act like a lawyer, to speak like a lawyer. And by lawyer here, I mean, to write and speak to fellow lawyers, to judges, to law professors. Right, so that's the traditional way in which law schools have progressed, and especially for highly ranked law schools, that this is important in terms of the academic output, but as well as the employability of their students. So some of the highest ranked law schools in the world actually have very good employment track records. Right, a lot of their students go out and have great jobs, and that makes them more desirable. So if you wanted to teach these things on law and technology skills, there's a question about how do you find a candidate who can and will be willing and able to teach that? And I guess at Hong Kong U, They were able to find somebody like me, and there are precious few individuals like that, I think, around the world. Increasingly, we are growing that circle across the world, and with similar law labs across the world. But I think we're part of the vanguard. So if I give you a brief overview of what we do in Light Lab, we started with two courses. We're only less than 2 years old, right? So we started two courses last year. This year we have seven courses, and they can be broken down in a few different ways. So you'll recall that they are interdisciplinary and experiential. That means that while most of my students are law students, some of them are not. So my students end up as student researchers working with tech startups. So importantly, they're not giving legal advice, but they're actually assisting those tech startups with legal related research questions. And that's more in relation to the law of tech side. My students also have opportunities to work as interns with these tech startups, but also with NGOs who are working on the tech and innovation policy space. My students also have the chance to work with NGOs and social entrepreneurs as part of their social impact entrepreneurship course. So overall, these are some of our experiential programs. And just this semester alone, we had to match 40 students with different kinds of experiences. But we're lucky enough to have a good outreach, and we had more than 70 companies outreach to us to work with our students. Now, that's more in relation to the law of tech side of things. Now, in relation to the tech of law side of things, I've got one course, a foundational light course, which ostensibly is a survey course in relation to entrepreneurial law. And the students there are actually creating legal tech artifacts as their deliverables. So the expression I have is, I don't want them to create something that only they read and I read. I want something that's actually meaningful and impactful. So my students have created document automation. They've created video explainers, and they've even created chatbots. And the idea is all of these will be put on our Light Lab website, which will be launched later this semester. And therefore, hopefully, be a source of legal information, not legal advice, legal information to under-resourced companies and organizations. So if you are a tech startup, you are an NGO, you are a social entrepreneur, often you don't have access to a lawyer to ask some really basic, questions to understand, what your basic rights are. We want our website to be the go-to place to assist them. But of course, if they need more details, please, they should we'll guide them towards a lawyer because we're not giving legal advice. Now, this semester, what we're quite excited about is then launching our law tech and reg tech sandbox. So we've extended our concepts one step further. So besides the website, our students have also created law tech tools co-designed with NGOs to address access to justice. Last year, we learned about this great competition called IronTech Lawyer Invitational, run by Georgetown University. So our students qualified to participate in that. I got funding to bring us all to Washington, D.C. for the finals, but COVID meant that we had to do it all online. And as it turns out, our students pitched for that, and they won. So it just goes to show that we have lots of great talent here, and dare I say it, perhaps some of my pedagogies seems to be working well. This semester, to extend that concept, we actually have law students now working with general counsels. So with outreach, so when I was in-house at Credit Suisse, I was also on the executive committee of the Corporate Counsel Association here in Hong Kong. And so I know many of the ecosystem here in terms of the multinationals and the corporates here in Hong Kong. So we said, well, why don't we have the students build proof of concepts co-designed with in-houses so that we can address some of the pain points, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on. And we're pleasantly surprised by the fantastic support that we've had from the in-house community. So this semester, my students are actually building proof of concept legal tech to address real-world needs with in-houses. So as for integrating, so as you can tell, we've been quite busy. So from two courses to seven, but we're still only a program and it's only an elective. So I think your question was about integrating it. I think slowly and surely. What my observation would be that if one were a highly ranked law school, already they're doing lots of things well and correct. So there may be a feel for not needing to change much. So very often we have lots of we do have innovative law schools that are trying to integrate it more. But how shall I say, for the more highly ranked law schools, there's actually more of a little bit more resistance around it. But you know, so that's why I consider myself fortunate to be at Hong Kong U and for them to be quite progressive in the thinking there. But I think it's a matter of supply and demand. If the profession doesn't demand it, some and therefore from a ranking point of view, it doesn't have as much of an impact. Law schools may traditionally be not as quick to adapt to it, but to be honest, this is the same across a lot of the emerging spaces that I'm working in. So I do quite a bit of work in the fintech space as well, and it's the same. It takes I'm learning how long it takes to introduce new courses, let alone new degrees. I'm fortunate again in Hong Kong U to be part of teams that, you know, for example, in the last few years we've launched new Bachelor of Arts and Science fintech degrees to address the fintech space. So legal tech, its time will come. Some law schools are starting it already, but I'm sure it will be an increasing trend.
Great, thank you. Talking about those legal skills of the future and about those new mindset that need to be adopted, what do you think they consist of?
Well, that's a big question. So there are quite a few frameworks around, and I've actually written briefly about this as well. So I you know, on the side, I kind of call it kind of the alphabet soup lawyers, right? So there's the T-shaped lawyer that has been talked about for almost nearly a decade now, and again, that came from a different context. And therefore, you know, it talks about the lawyer not just needing the domain knowledge skills, but skills in relation to project management and also in relation to technology. There's the delta shaped legal professional that has is another paradigm that's being introduced. And specifically, they talk about the legal professional. So it's not just about a lawyer now, but somebody having the different skill sets in terms of people, processes. I forgot the last P now. And practice, I believe, that allow legal professionals to understand and excel as in terms of the different parts of the ecosystem they are. Then there's a group of English in-house lawyers that have introduced the concept of the O-shaped lawyers, again focused on more outward. Various softer skills, I think some might call them as well. And a lot of these relate to so-called, you know, sometimes called softer skills, as opposed to the technical domain skills. So for me, in terms of what some of the future skills that are required, and in fact, you know, when designing the LTIC course, I think of that as kind of a taster course of what I have been, you know, introducing to my students, except that what I introduce to my students over a whole semester, this will be done over a couple of hours, so it very much is a taster. So if I were to take a high level, some of these are phrases that I think you will be well known to you and your listeners, and are part of the LTIC course. So the first is, you know, legal design thinking, right? So being client or user centric. I also introduced business model canvas because a lot of law students don't may know the law, but they don't actually understand the nature of businesses and how businesses work. And so if you don't understand that, you don't understand that the paradigms in which you know, legal issues can and will arise. Then there's computational algorithmic thinking. Again, I'm of the school of thought of promoting no code and low code rather than promoting, you know, lawyers learn to code in Python. I think there definitely is a space for that. It's just in terms of the framework that I use, I think it's more important to have lawyers understand how code works and think like code, and to be able to communicate with developers rather than actually code themselves. And then last but not least is agile methodology and project-based learning. So my students all work on projects in an iterative manner. And so we give them the basics of understanding that, especially if they're going to be working with technologists and understanding that process. You know, built into this is innovation, and that's kind of a holy grail. It's easy to talk about, it's hard to crystallize. The approach that I've been kind of developing, and I hope to publish on this sometime soon, is what I call hackathon as pedagogy. So as you may recall, I organized Global Legal Hackathon, and there I saw the magic of what can happen over a span of time when you add a diversity of people in a concentrated problem statements. So with our INTECH Lawyer Invitational, we've had some early wins already where our students have, you know, they full credit to them, you know, they went over and beyond, you know, what I was putting forward on our curriculum. But, you know, our course is very open-ended. So if you have the skills, we are able to match you and expand that as well. So our students create an NLP data bank. So they use natural language processing based on an open source framework. And what they did was they created a tool that helps injured workers analyze and better understand their rights under, you know, workers' compensation or employee compensation. So if an injured worker were 25 years old and lost their left arm, you know, how much, you know, in the past might such a person have been offered in terms of compensation? Is that fair? And so they created a data bank specifically for that. More recently, some of my students joined what our Faculty of Engineering has launched. So they've launched an Innovation Academy, and they've invited different faculty members members across the 10 faculties to participate in that. And in their InnoSpark pitching competition, a group of my students participate in that, and they won as well. So their proposal was to create a VR system to assist with unrepresented litigants, so that the litigants, as you would know, if you're not a lawyer and you've never been to a court, it can be pretty terrifying and scary. So they're proposing a VR system to enable such litigants to better understand and appreciate before they step foot into a real courtroom. So I think so in terms of the skills, I think this is how I would characterize some of the key legal skills of the future.
Great, thank you. So we will turn to some more practical tools to increase legal tech adoption in a minute. But before that, as we said, you've worked at Credit Suisse in Hong Kong. You've also worked in New York, California. You've been in Australia. So you've really been around the world, and based on that international experience in the corporate world, I was wondering what are some pain points and obstacles that you have noticed which hinder greater adoption of technology and innovation?
Oh, there are quite a few. So what actually is, well, as you say, I've had quite a varied experience through my career. I think more relevantly, LightLab actually collaborated with the Association of Corporate Counsel here in Asia, together with Eversheds, and we published a report, a survey and a report on legal leadership during the COVID period, right? So the name of the report was entitled Eliminating the New Normal, Asia Pacific Legal Counsel in a Time of Unprecedented Change. So we actually asked you know, the membership of the ACC across the Asia Pacific some of these questions, right? And I think you know, you may find that, and your listeners may find it of interest, and I'm happy to share the link with you and your listeners if you like. But you know, a lot of it is I think can be summarized in three ways. Firstly, it has to do with with a culture, right? So it's mindsets and skill sets. If you are a good lawyer, traditionally you knew how to, you know, you are analytical, you thought through the problem, and you could answer it well and were responsive, right? But if you wanted to use technology, suddenly your skills as a good lawyer might actually change, right? Do you know, and are you comfortable with managing that? And you know, there's a joke about a lot of people who went to law school because they didn't like, you know, math and technology. So so there is that predicament of sorts. So are good lawyers within firms and corporates able and willing to adapt that mindset and roll up their sleeves and you know, and adopt greater skill sets as well? Secondly, there's kind of a measurement of the value of the role, and that's a perennial issue for corporate counsel, right? So the way I describe it is, you know, corporate counsel traditionally is a back office role, right? So you're a fixed cost. So how do you show that you have value? And for many years, you know, there's always talk about being a seat at the table. Don't get me wrong, corporate counsel can have the ear of the CEO, and many corporate counsel even become CEOs. Like, look at Microsoft, right? So corporate counsel can be tremendously valued, but in an age of talking about technology and innovation, suddenly a lot of corporate counsel have again that challenge, where I was an astute advisor of being able to analyze risks. Legal risks and regulatory risks. Suddenly, I'm asked to analyze technological risk, and use technology. So this is not a, you know, this can be quite a foreign concept to a lot of traditional, you know, great lawyers, right? And last but not least, it's budget. So and again, I think that. It's twofold. So one needs to remember that in the legal industry, there are almost like two or three types of applications of law tech, right? So and lawyers. So one is in a law firm context. The second is in the corporate context. And then the third is, you know, in an access to justice context. So in the law firm context, you know, the challenge is traditionally law firms made money by charging more time, right? The more time you spend on it, the more money you make on it. So if law tech actually reduces your amount of time that you spend on it, is that a good thing for law firms? So that requires them to really rethink, you know, if they're that way inclined, their business models, right? So for corporate counsel, the issue becomes, okay, so we're a fixed cost. No matter how, you know, if we're a team of 5 or 10, no matter what work comes in, we do. If there's more work, we still have to do. If there's less work, we still have to do. Now we have to ask for money, not necessarily for headcount, but for technology. Is that an implication that we're not doing things as efficiently as we could or should, right? And again, so that's a challenge and an argument that a lot of our corporate counsel need to be willing and able to address confidently. And to be able to speak to their CFOs to get that funding, and then last but not least, it's access to justice. So a lot of the public, you know, the civil justice community, very well meaning, very impactful in terms of serving the public. But again, a great, you know, public service lawyer is not necessarily a great technologically inclined lawyer. Right, or social worker, and so therefore there is that discussion that needs to be had with the NGOs in terms of the benefits that technology can bring to improve their impact and benefit the community and society and the beneficiaries that they seek to serve when they may be traditionally resistant to some of this, and then finding the budget to pay for that as well.
Okay, thank you. And as we said, As well, given your acquaintance with different industries, so research, capital marketplaces, RegTech, LawTech, AI governance, and law firms in particular, how do you think the adoption of technology is going in the legal sector in particular, especially in comparison with other sectors?
So I laugh because at one stage, as I said, when I was much more involved, which I still am in RegTech, some of my corporate counsel friends would say, "How come we don't see you around? You're not spending time with us." And I used to say, "Well, you don't have budget, whereas your compliance colleagues have budget, right?" But joking aside, let me take a step back. So a lot of people talk about COVID as being a source of digital transformation. And that certainly is true. And we can, again, talk about that separately as well. But if you want to compare against other sectors, maybe let me throw kind of three potential sectors for by way of little comparison, right? So in the financial institution sector and financial services, this thing called fintech arose. Right, and now Hong Kong has just changed its licensing regime, and we've got eight new virtual banks. Right, in the UK, you call them neobanks or challenger banks, but here we've got eight new licensed virtual banks, fully licensed. Right, except that they don't have any branches. So with fintech, the drivers there were competitive pressures. Right, so if you're an incumbent. Besides having a virtual bank, you now have an online only asset manager, right? Sometimes so-called, although it's a bit a misnomer, robo-advisor. So if your competition is now getting purely digital, that adds more pressure for you to do it, right? So I think in finance and in fintech and financial services, it's really competitive pressures that are pushing that adoption of technology further ahead. So in the RegTech space, so if you are RegTech is often defined as regulatory technology, normally linked to the financial industry, although some do rightfully, expand that beyond the financial industry. So how does RegTech work? So again, RegTech is a back office function. So it is not a technology that helps you get more clients generally. It helps you pay less fines. Right, or not be sanctioned by the regulator. So because of the nature of that, the role of the regulator is so important. So very often, the push and pressure for that, for RegTech adoption comes more from a top-down point of view, right? So hence, I spend a lot of time with regulators in the RegTech space to encourage the adoption of RegTech. And so we're really pleased when last year at FinTech Week, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, which is kind of the equivalent of the UK FCA in relation to banks, introduced their 2-year adoption roadmap for RegTech. And so this was very much a direction that the regulators have said that they want the industry to adopt. And the FCA in the UK is one of the most progressive in terms of promotion of RegTech around the world. Including launching of regulatory sandboxes. They were the first to do that, and others have followed. They're the first to do tech sprints. So, in other words, hackathons for RegTech was promoted by the regulator there. And now increasingly tech challenges are being adopted by regulators around the world as well. So the FCA is very proactive there, but that is a top-down approach. Now with legal tech, one of the reasons why it's a little bit slower, I think, is there really isn't as much competitive pressure, right? It's at least in most jurisdictions around the world, and there's relatively little top-down pressure as well. So the regulators of lawyers, mainly law societies, are generally not pushing as much. I mean, the jurisdictions that tend to be more progressive, that push, that's where you see the greater advances, and we can talk about some of those. But I think that's how I would kind of compare law versus at least some of the industries that I'm much more familiar with and involved in. With COVID, yes, definitely, law tech in the area of communications and e-signatures and knowledge management, all of them have definitely grown. And in fact, the survey that we ran has indicated that the highest priorities of GCs in Asia Pacific are to introduce more contract management, e-signatures, document automation, and document management, right? So all of that is heading in kind of the right direction, and COVID has been a big impetus for that. But one cynical view is, so if a lawyer now uses Zoom, is Zoom a legal tech, right? e-signatures, yes, okay, that's definitely a legal tech. But so how integrated and what aspects are they integrating that into their practices or into their operations? I think does vary quite a bit in across the industry and across different jurisdictions.
Great, thank you. Drawing from your experience, and you've mentioned it thoroughly, especially you are also the principal instructor of Asia's first fintech MOOC on edX. So drawing from all those experiences, what are the best tools to foster innovation and adoption of technology? Which practices are to be preferred? Are there some particularly efficient exercises? And also, are these the same for law students, lawyers, and legal practitioners?
Well, in the current COVID environment, everybody's now living online, and so online learning tools have certainly been du jour. And that's certainly been the case at universities, but also elsewhere. So I think that's generally a good thing. So some of the more common tools include Zoom, of course, but I've also always been a big fan of blended learning. So being able to watch information online, and especially with the YouTube generation, there is a lot that you can learn at your own pace and your own timing. I'm also a big fan of no code and low code platforms, as you've heard. And so this will allow folk to basically DIY and be able to embrace some of these technologies. But last but not least, I'm a big fan of peer learning. So that's a big difference between people who are learning just by themselves, but their ability to actually work with other people and learn from their peers is particularly relevant and rich. I wanted to give on your question regarding whether it's the same for law students, lawyers, and legal practitioners. I wanted to give a little bit of an example where yes, it definitely is different, but in some ways similar. So in the past, I've been a fan of Dialogflow, which was acquired by Google, and Dialogflow is a chatbot making tool. But I've used Dialogflow in at least in each of the three different contexts that I of my work. So in ACMI, I actually collaborated with the head of AI for HSBC, and we used Dialogflow as part of Hong Kong FinTech Week to train finance executives how to create a chatbot for a virtual bank. And by the way, he then used the same curriculum to train HSBC executives internally. I've used Dialogflow as part of my Young Maker Changemaker program, where we had middle school and high school students as part of an AI for SDG program, i.e., AI for to address UN sustainable goals. And the students created chatbots that helped address the situation of a terrible typhoon in Hong Kong and allowed people to access emergency resources in if they were struck by the typhoon. And last but not least, I've used a Dialogflow for my class last year, where my students, these are university students now, created chatbots which were integrated into Slack as well as Messenger. So the same tool can be used by lots of different audiences, but one might like to think that a quote-unquote good teacher knows how to distinguish between communicating similar tools for different audiences.
Great, thank you so much. Given your international background as well, can you provide some insights into how the legal tech industry in Asia is faring compared to the UK, the EU, and the rest of the world? How are adoption rates? How do they compare?
Sure. So, as you may be aware, I'm on the steering committee of the Asia Legal Innovation and Technology Association, ALITA. So that's something we spend a lot of time thinking about and tracking and seeking to grow the ecosystem. So, by way of very brief summary, I think one way to think about it is the Asia legal tech, or firstly, the Asia legal industry is not as large as, say, the US or the UK and Europe. The firms are not as large, so therefore, which has a linkage to profitability. And similarly, a lot of the companies don't have as large corporate counsel groupings. So all of that has a correlation to the profitability and therefore the adoption of legal tech. And so one will find in Asia it tends to be quite disparate and generally not as fast as the UK or Europe, but there certainly are some very good bright spots. So some of the bright spots that include Australia. So when Clock moved to Asia, their first port of call was Australia, where there are sizable, disproportionately large law firms, which, as you may know, in the last few years have merged with UK Magic Circle firms, and large corporates as well. So Clock has a great presence there, and the legal tech market there is supported by private industry, but also by the profession and by academia.
As part of the LTIC, which we have recently launched, you are covering a module, Legal Skills of the Future. Can you tell us a bit more about the module?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier on, in some ways it's a taster of some of what I'm introducing to the law students at Light Lab, and also to some of the practitioners that we've been engaged in as well when organizing hackathons. So it will cover the your question, some of the aspects of the question that you had posed, which is in terms of what the legal skills of the future would be, namely legal design thinking, being client and user centric, business model canvas to better understand the business models of clients and users, computation and algorithmic thinking, again with a focus on no code, low code as opposed to coding, and agile and methodology and project based learning. So the idea is to actually work on projects rather than just pure hypotheticals. So hopefully it'll be a nice taster for the students of the LTIC course.
Amazing. Very, very excited for this. Well, thank you for your time, Brian. It was great to have your insight on legal skills of the future. If you're interested in legal tech, you can visit fortemarkets.com to keep up with all of our events, such as our Legal Tech Smarter, our yearly Global Legal Tech Summit, and much more. Go to LTI.institute to learn more about the Legal Technology and Innovation Certificate, the LTIC, which aims to bring a breadth of understanding and engagement to legal practitioners around the world to enable them to engage fully with all relevant technology. Applications for our second cohort starting in October 2021 has now opened. I hope you have enjoyed this month's podcast. Please note that the University of Hong Kong Faculty of Law has been nominated for the FT Innovative Lawyers New Global Collaborative Innovation Award. We're delighted to invite you to join them during the FT Innovative Lawyer Asia Pacific Virtual Awards on May 13th to support and vote for them.